Hello and welcome to the Main Reader on Main Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. Copyright 2006 by Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora, published by University Press of New England, Lebanon, New Hampshire. In the last episode, Danny Young and Scott Heracles had just returned from Troy, Alabama, where they had interviewed Russ Gorman and other witnesses in the case. We resume Finding Amy with episode 16, starting on page 170. Chapter 15. On Friday, December 14th, while Danny Young and Scott Heracles were in Troy, Alabama, working on the case, and probation and parole was bringing Gorman back to Maine, Amy St. Lawrence's family and friends gathered in the chapel at Conroy Tully Funeral Home in South Portland to hold a memorial service for her. Although her principal champions were unable to be there, representatives from the Portland and Maine State Police were. A large, framed photograph of Amy stood on a table at the front of the chapel, while 25 white candles set amid evergreens and pink roses marked the years of her short life. The same kind of roses Amy's father, Dennis, had given her every year on her birthday. Pink roses for Amy, yellow for Julie. A sad reminder that there would be no more birthdays. Amy's mother, Diane Jenkins, told the listeners that her daughter would rather celebrate her life than dwell on how it ended, while her stepfather, Don Jenkins, reminded her friends to keep her memory alive by sharing their stories among themselves and with others who had not known her. Her mother recited the prayer of Saint Francis. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. The prayer summed up Amy's character for those who had known her. Amy St. Lawrence had been a loving and generous young woman, a giver, not a taker, and a consoler of those who needed consolation. Amy's mother chose it, as well as a message from Amy to those she had left behind about how their lives should be lived in remembrance of her. The Reverend Eric Kelly urged his listeners to honor Amy St. Lawrence's memory by making choices that would make the world a safer place for themselves and for others. We are gathered today because of a profound tragedy that defies words. We also are gathered because of a young woman who packed a lot of living in 25 short years. Summing up the woman investigators had come to know, Kelly said, her living was marked by generosity, optimism, kindness, enthusiasm, humor, and love of life. Amy Elizabeth St. Lawrence, her composed, smiling face staring at me again, only this time, from the obituary page. 25 of South Berwick, who was missing since October 21, 2001, was found Saturday, December 8, 2001, in Scarborough. 0703. My TV LED blinks as the smell of coffee mixed with newspaper moves through my nose. Newsprint smears on my fingers, making them feel thick. Today is the day of the memorial service. The worst will be watching and absorbing everyone's pain and sadness. She attended Portland schools, was employed for the past 5 years as a secretary technician at Pratt & Whitney. She was fond of her cat, Alex. Oh, yeah, the cat. I recall the cat at the gravesite. So strange, so poignant. She is survived by The list is long, and many friends that will miss her dearly. My pager bleeps, jarring me from quiet thought. For a moment, I think, geez, can't we ever have a little peace and quiet? But the truth is, with this job, we can't. It's Tom, explaining that there's a lot going on. Danny and Scott are in Alabama, and soon they'll be sitting down with Gorman. There is an early morning staff meeting and a detectives meeting in the case. We still have a tremendous amount of work, documentation, and follow-up to do. And at this stage, we're proceeding with meticulous caution. We do not want to lose this guy to some loophole. It's Friday, December 14th, 2001. Another weekend approaching with no weekend for the guys. Tom, I say, I don't care. I am going to the service today. Did Matt call in yet? Hold off on that meeting till 1300 and get Bruce to take over the evidence technicians. The Conroy Tully Chapel is in South Portland, a funeral home. Not a church like I'd anticipated, given my Catholic upbringing. It looks stark and cold from the outside. Matt and I park our cars across the street. Many times police officers attend such services to survey the crowd and look for suspects and information, but our suspect is in jail. Our presence here is personal. Matt is once again perfectly dressed in a gray suit, freshly pressed shirt. Immaculate. The GQ detective. I adjust my suit and tie, polishing my shoes on the back of my pant legs. Matt looks at me funny. Listen, I say, it works. I do it all the time. Matt is polishing his glasses, and we look at each other. This is going to be tough, but there is strength in numbers. I dread seeing Diane and Julie, recalling my own parents' pain when my brother Anthony was laid out in his coffin. That's the worst part of this job, the worst, observing people in such pain. We see so much pain. Sometimes you can just see it build up until the anguish is so great people are visibly searching for a way to escape, longing to leave their own bodies or just completely throw themselves into grief like screaming infants. It's primal and horribly disturbing. The crowd is shuffling and snaking around to get in line, all those bodies giving off aftershave and perfume. Suits and nice dresses, ties and polished shoes mingle with dirty shoes and outfits hastily pulled together. The long line slowly moves into the funeral home and then into the chapel, people bumping into each other, distracted and numb. Inside the funeral home is warm and inviting, but the air is heavy with sorrow. I see Lucille first. She gives me a sad smile, and we embrace. I ask where Diane is, preparing myself for the first sight of her since the morning of the day we found Amy. I throw my arm around the ever-stoic Matt as we move into the chapel. I see the familiar framed picture of Amy on the table, surrounded by white candles, greens, and lovely pink roses. My neck is tight and my palms are sweaty. I spot Diane ahead, moving through the shuffling, halting line until I reach her. She is so composed and graceful, so elegantly put together, but her long, immaculate hair frames a face in which the eyes are tragically sad. She gives me a gracious smile, so glad and pleased to see that Matt and I have come. I wrap my arms around her, embracing her with a heartfelt hug. We've been through 7 awful weeks together. This is not merely a professional courtesy. This is for Amy. This is for her family. In my arms, Diane gives a slight heave, her body shaking, her head bent to hide her face. We're supposed to box it up, lock it out, and get on with the job. I've stored up 20-plus years of stifling my emotions while witnessing the howl of human agony. Now I worry it will come spilling out. I'm so close to this one. Thank you so much for bringing Amy home, she says. It was Danny, Diane, Danny and Scott, and a lot of other people. We move on to Amy's sister, Julie, the little sister. So close to Amy, still struggling to comprehend all this. I know about losing a sibling, about the space it leaves in a family, in your mind. Poor Julie, eyes downcast, her blonde hair falling forward, eyelashes brushing the tops of her cheekbones. Her sorrow is weighty and tangible. She wipes a tear away with poise and precision. She has her mother's grace. Julie, I say. We hug, and I feel her body shaking with tears. Your sister is okay, Julie. She's okay and safe with God. I believe that. You believe that. It's true. Then on to Amy's father, Dennis, and Kathy Emery, and to her stepfather, Don, all of them so terribly sad. We embrace, shake hands. Dennis thanks me again in a sad, gravelly voice. You guys did a good job. I know Dennis's life has not been easy and that his lovely daughter was a source of great pride and joy. Now his suffering is mute and terrible. As we take our seats and the ceremony begins, a whiff of pine flashes me back to the night of the dig, to the needles sprinkled on her grave, the pine needles buried with her. We are here to celebrate a life, but my head is full of death. Diane is composed and eloquent as she speaks, telling us Amy would want us to celebrate her life rather than dwell on her death. She recites the prayer of St. Francis, which is something I try to repeat every day. Another strange connection in this case. Is it Amy speaking to me? Speaking to us? Reverend Kelly tells us, we are free beings in a world that is both wonderful and dangerous at the same time. We've had to recognize the reality of evil that can and does destroy so much of what we love, and it is something that must be confronted. I know evil exists. All cops do. I think of confrontation and how I'd like to confront Gorman. I imagine, that's as far as it gets, as a caring human being, I'd like to confront Gorman. As a trained and experienced police officer, I've learned to handle those feelings and suppress the emotions. Always that split between the personal and the professional. It takes a toll, though. I'm sure Matt feels the same. I quickly turn to prayer and stop the intrusion. I listen to the talk about Amy, imagining her as an angel now. Rest in peace, Amy, I think, and help us all in this crazy world. Move among us in grace. Outside in the cold, Matt and I are approached by the news, and each of us makes statements. Matt says, all the investigators involved from both agencies have made a tremendous personal and professional commitment to the case. As a group, we are extremely optimistic and resolved to see it to its successful conclusion. Well done, Matt, I think. I am proud of him and us. I say a few words about how difficult the investigation has been, both with the situation and working with multiple agencies. That Amy kept us together, another positive influence of Amy in the midst of this horrible tragedy. I reflect to myself that tremendous is a good word. In my entire career, I have never observed such an effective working relationship between agencies to get a job completed. Rarely have we had a case go on so long with such intensity. It was a monumental challenge, putting egos, rank, agency protocol aside, and keeping everyone together. In my leadership challenges, I felt it was a personal triumph, keeping everyone locked in. Thank you, Amy, I think. Dan and Scott, the final glue that brought you home. I leave feeling sad, but at least they can finally have a funeral. I think of all the cases where that doesn't happen, where families wait years or decades or forever and never get an answer. The missing person's room maintained, untouched. I've seen the toll it takes. One young couple who had been recipients of Amy's generosity left a letter at the service. Their story was that several years before they had been financially strapped, their rent was due, and they were facing a bleak Christmas for their child. Amy, aware of their situation, had taken money out of her savings account, filled an envelope, and given it to them. Their letter read, "Dear Amy, you're the truest, most sincere friend we ever had. You're a constant ray of light in our life, never judged or spoke unkindly toward anyone. You were there for us at our lowest points, and we always swore if you ever needed us, we would be there for you. We were wrong, and we'll be eternally sorry and heartstruck that we couldn't help you when you needed someone the most. We know you're in heaven. We think of heaven as a place reserved for the best of humankind, which does not even begin to describe you. The person or persons who did this to you must not have known you, because anyone who knew you would have laid down their life for you. We can take comfort from knowing that you are looking down on us all, and we pray we will see you again someday. All our love, Amy. Amy St. Laurent was the girl who used her own money to fly her best friend Kate home from Alaska as a surprise for Kate's grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary. She was the girl who took a leave of absence from work to sit in the hospital by the bedside of a friend who was in a coma, talking for hours about things they'd done together. She was the merry girl who played Mrs. Claus at the Pratt & Whitney Christmas party and hid Easter eggs for the children. Amy St. Laurent was celebrated as a person who was generous and loving, who was always thinking of others and giving them whatever she had, whether it was her time, her attention, or the contents of her savings account. And in the midst of their tears, as they recounted their special stories about Amy, those who loved her could not avoid the bitterness of knowing that a person who had done so much to enhance life had been taken from them in a brutal and horrific way by a young man who had never done anything with his life except indulge himself and prey on other people. Chapter 16. Danny Young and Scott Heracles might have taken a Sunday off to spend time with their families after their marathon trip to Alabama, but on Monday they were right back at work. There was a lot to process from their interviews in Troy. There would be more meetings with the medical examiner, more follow-up from the discovery of Amy's body. They continued to look for witnesses who might help them connect Gorman with a gun. They searched for Gorman's clothes and St. Laurent's clothes, or a place where they might have been burned, and the murder weapon. On December 10th, Portland police arranged to have divers search the small ponds near the spot where the body had been buried. On December 21st, responding in part to Erica Walker's statement that Gorman had told her he'd dropped the gun off a pier, state police, Marine Patrol, and Portland police divers searched Portland Harbor near Union Wharf and some of the adjacent piers. Because of Gorman's familiarity with the game room in the Westbrook area, and the possibility that Gorman might have retrieved the gun from Ryan Campbell's room on the Monday or Tuesday after the crime, police divers also searched the Presumpscot River in Westbrook behind the game room. They continued to question witnesses among the pool of young adults who hung around the old port or the pool hall, collecting information to fill out their picture of Gorman. Sergeant Stewart described these young people, with their marginal jobs and their pleasure-seeking lifestyles, as like college kids without the brains and the classes. Every night is a party, and every day is the time to sleep it off. They were people just living day to day. Scott Heracles added, every time we went to the apartment on Brighton Avenue, they were all asleep. As the detectives filled in their picture of Gorman's behavior toward women, they revised their original impression of him. At first, Young said his view of Gorman had been that the word predator was too harsh, but that here was a guy who used women for his own sexual benefit. Now that they knew more and had seen what he'd done to Amy, they concluded that Gorman was indeed a sexual predator. In the course of their investigation, Young and Heracles had located at least three young women who had had what they described as non-consensual sex with Gorman. All their stories were depressingly similar. The women had been with Gorman, he had made them a drink, or given them a drink, and they later found that they had had sex with him without a memory of the encounter, or recalled having a sexual encounter in which they were too dazed or helpless to protest or stop it. These stories were consistent with Ryan Campbell's speculation that Gorman used drugs to ensure his success. When one young woman, after a forced sexual encounter with Gorman, told her girlfriends what had happened, they shook their heads and said, join the club. In each case, the women did not report the assault or try to press charges because she felt so guilty, believing that it was her fault for letting it happen. Like any successful predator, Gorman was adept at selecting victims whose guilt, low self-esteem, or passive personalities would ensure his success and protect him from repercussions. Along with the stories of women Gorman had assaulted, the detectives heard how he behaved when women were not compliant. Two of Gorman's friends in Alabama described him reacting badly or becoming explosive when a woman turned him down. One young woman described Gorman trapping her and demanding to know whether it was going to happen, that is, whether she was going to have sex with him, and slamming her roughly up against a building when she told him it wasn't. He was really drunk, she said, and basically his character, when he's really drunk, he gets pretty violent. Shyla Cameron, who worked in the Iguana, told them that after Amy St. Laurent disappeared, Gorman accosted her, Cameron, at work, complaining that she wasn't very friendly to him anymore. When she told him she was not his friend and she felt that people weren't safe around him, he suddenly grabbed her by the throat. Another of Gorman's acquaintances told Young that Gorman was very persistent about sex. She stated that she knew how many women Gorman claimed to have sex with and that he would get angry if he was rejected by someone. Gorman had a history of violence, even toward those women with whom he was involved in long-term relationships. Gorman had beaten and kicked Kathleen Ferguson, the mother of his daughter, when she was a pregnant and vulnerable 17-year-old. Gorman had left threats in telephone messages to his ex-girlfriend Jamie, which her anxious mother had saved. Bob Milton, manager of the game room, who sometimes went out to eat or drink with Gorman, told how Gorman had expressed anger and hatred toward women, saying that he would like to shoot them in the face or cut their throat or put his foot up their ass. At some point in the early days after Amy St. Laurent was found, tension between state police and Portland police over Chief Chitwood's habit of speaking freely to the media boiled over. Since the night that Amy's body had been found, jurisdiction had officially transferred to the state police. In the interest of a good resolution of the case, the decision had been made to continue the cooperative relationship between the two agencies and to maintain two primary detectives. Concern over the chief's actions, however, eventually led to discussions about pulling the case away from Portland, leaving it exclusively with the state police. Because of their long-standing relationship, Deputy AG Bill Stokes called Danny Young to give him a heads-up about the situation. The call came when Young and Heracles were doing an interview at Paradigm Windows. When Young got off the phone, he told his partner, "Scotty, they're going to take my box," meaning his box of notebooks containing all the information. Heracles, unfazed, said, "Well, don't worry. The box stays with you. If they took it from you, they'd only give it to me, and I'm not taking it." Back at Portland Police Headquarters, Sergeant Stewart took Heracles out into the lobby on the detective's floor and told him that steps were underway where they might be going to take the case. Just as he'd told his partner, Heracles told his sergeant that if they did pull the case from Portland, they'd better get someone else to work it because he wasn't taking it. Later, Young grabbed a box of case files and marched into Lieutenant Laughlin's office while Laughlin was talking with Sergeant Stewart. Holding it out, he told his surprised lieutenant, "If you want the damned box, you can have the box." The matter was eventually resolved in a meeting between the two agencies. On the phone in my office, I look up to see a bemused Bill Stokes leaning in my doorway, just waiting on me, his shoulder pressed against the doorframe. Typical Stokes, animated and slightly disheveled, suit opened, tie swinging. I hang up, and before I even speak, he starts, "Where's the iceberg, Joe? Are you going to let me know before it hits? Where's the iceberg?" He removes his glasses as he steps into my office. "What iceberg? What are you talking about, Bill?" "I'm talking about Chitwood, Joe. Chitwood." "Well, what about him?" "He's going to hurt this case with his open mic to the press. You know, Joe, technically this is an MSP case. I don't want to take this away from you guys, but your department is going to hurt this. Bill and I have a great relationship, but now I'm getting mad. Bill, why the hell are you telling me this? Go to the chief. I can't tell the chief. I already went through this same crap with Fern on another case. The issue is with him, not me. You know our media views are diametrically opposed to your office and MSP. You know how he is with the press. But look, damn it, he's an honorable guy. Just talk to him. You're the prosecutor. We go on. Suddenly, he says, "Hey, is that a granola bar?" I look at my left hand, which has just automatically removed one from my top drawer. "Yeah, you want one?" Bill has an amazing energy about him. It's like he's moving all the time. I see his lips smack, and I toss a chocolate chip bar at him, which he snaps in midair like a frog catching a fly. "You know, Joe, this is serious." "Yeah, no shit, Bill, no shit, and I don't need this now, when we've come so far. Come on, let's go to the meeting." I get Tim Burton and tell him that I need his help at this meeting. We all squeeze into the conference room, Matt, Tom, Scott, Dan, Tim, Bill, and I. There are books, folders, case files all over the place. It's his ball now as a prosecutor, and Bill knows it as he starts out. We go over strategy, and then he quickly gets to Chief Chitwood and the media, its impact on the case. Tim knows it's going to be his job to talk to the chief, a precarious situation, as Chief Chitwood backs down from no one. He would unleash a tirade on Stokes, La Rochelle, and anyone else who confronted him. So it's a matter of presentation. Tim looks weary. He has so much going on managing this bureau. As the meeting continues, Tim slowly rises and leaves on his mission. In the end, it all worked out. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.